Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the one and only Sean Sports Stop podcast. That's right, the greatest podcast in the world. I've been consistent lately, so y'all better watch out. Y'all better watch out. The king is back. The king is back. We have a lot to talk about. The Los Angeles Dodgers are making moves. Man, is it awesome to be a huge Dodger fan right now. NBA, NFL, obviously MLB offseason. The stove is officially red hot. The hot stove is red hot, white hot even, you could say. So with all of that said, I just want to give a quick shout out to Crimson IT. If you or someone you know has a small or medium-sized company that needs either managed IT services or cybersecurity, head over to crimsonit.com and tell them that you found them from me, your boy, the Sean Sports Thought Podcast, and I promise they'll hook you up, they'll give you a discount, you will get taken care of. With all of that said, let's get right into it, starting off with some NBA. The NBA in-season tournament is in the books. LeBron James has collected some more hardware for his trophy cabinet, and it feels like as good a time as any to hand out NBA report cards. At or around the quarter mark of this 2023-24 season, we've already learned a lot about LeBron's Los Angeles Lakers and every other team in the league. Quote-unquote small sample size warnings don't need to be tossed out as much. Rotations are crystallizing and contenders are emerging. There's still plenty of time for things to change for every team in the NBA, of course. It's a very volatile and unpredictable league, but there's also plenty to base these grades on as well. Analyzing the records, individual performances, team numbers, and more against preseason expectations, here's where every team is on the good old A through F scale. We're going in alphabetical order, starting off with the Atlanta Hawks. I'll give them a C. An early season shooting slump sort of threw people off Trae Young, but he's quietly having a pretty absurd offensive season. He's averaging over 27 points and over 10.5 assists while posting a just below average true shooting percentage. The problem is that the Atlanta Hawks are below 500, barely outscoring opponents when Trae Young plays, and actually posting a slightly better point differential when he's not playing. As the current unquestioned face of the franchise, you'd like the most basic indicator of success, plus minus, to look a little bit better. Of course, those marks are not entirely on Trae Young himself. Basketball is a team sport, and he's not solely responsible for the Atlanta Hawks once again being near the bottom of the league on defense. Players like Clint Capella, Onyeka Okongwu, and DeAndre Hunter have to be better on that end, especially as breakout forward Jalen Johnson continues to recover from a wrist injury. Of all the players on this team, he might somehow be the most important. When Atlanta has Johnson's shooting and multi-positional defense on the floor, it is plus 5.2 points per 100 possessions compared to minus 2.7 when he's off. Next up, the Boston Celtics. They remind me of the Dodgers quite a bit, the NBA version of the Dodgers. They're such a well-run organization from top to bottom, and that's really hard for me to say and painful for me to say even as a diehard Laker fan, but I have to give the Celtics an A. Notwithstanding a calf injury that caused Kristaps Porzingis some recent games, the additions of him and Jrue Holiday to the Boston Celtics have looked absolutely brilliant. With Jrue Holiday and Derek White, Boston has probably the best and most dynamic defensive backcourt in the NBA. Both can more than bother either guard spot. They can defend up into the forward slots even, and that has taken a ton of pressure off the rest of the lineup, freeing Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown to focus even more on offense and not have to worry as much about defense. As for Porzingis, the defensive attention that he commands 30 feet from the basket is having the desired effect on the offense, with bigs forced to cover him outside. Driving lanes for Derek White, Jrue Holiday, Jason Tatum, and Jaylen Brown are roomier than ever. And though there are more questions for the bench than there are for the first five, having Al Horford to anchor a group that includes Sam Hauser shooting and Peyton Pritchard's occasional hot streaks should give them enough depth for a deep playoff run yet again. Next up, the Brooklyn Nets. Forever associated with the Boston Celtics, I'll give them a B+. The Brooklyn Nets didn't enter this season as a contender or anything near it, really, so perhaps their flying under the radar should not be all that surprising. But since Ben Simmons went down with another back injury, they've quietly surged into the top 10 in net rating behind an explosive three-point heavy attack led by Cam Thomas, Mikal Bridges, and plenty of scoring balance after that. The presence of wings like Mikal Bridges, Cam Johnson, Dorian Finney-Smith, and Royce O'Neal still gives them a relatively intriguing and theoretically switchable defense as well, but they're winning games on the other end of the floor right now. There are still questions about Brooklyn's lack of size. There's a lot on Nick Claxton's relatively slight shoulders, but the team has sidestepped that issue for now with shooting. Next up, the Charlotte Hornets. Fitting for them, I'll give them a C+. The Charlotte Hornets seemed like a borderline lock for another lottery appearance after this season, so their sub-500 record and bottom 5 net rating is not surprising at all. In fact, with the appropriate expectations in mind, Charlotte has actually been fairly competitive, especially since LaMelo Ball exited the rotation with an ankle injury. The Hornets were blown out in the first game that LaMelo missed, but they're minus 13 in four games since then. And solid performances from veterans Terry Rozier and Gordon Hayward, both former Celtics, by the way, during this stretch could pay dividends in the long run. Contending teams in need of a heat check scorer like Rozier or a big steady-handed point forward like Hayward may be willing to part with real assets for either one of them ahead of the February trade deadline. Those guys are the type of players that are in trade rumors every single season. So even if the Hornets finish near the bottom of the East, emerging with another lottery pick of their own and an extra first or two from around the league would warrant a passing grade. Next up, the Chicago Bulls. They have not been good. I'll give them a C-. For a minute there, it looked like the Chicago Bulls were headed for a dismal campaign and eventual fire sale in the trade market, and they may still eventually get there, but a couple things kept their grade around the average range. First, even if the front office didn't agree with the assessment, few fans or media members could have expected much more success than this from a core that's already demonstrated that it does not work together. Over the two seasons prior to this one, Chicago was minus 1.3 points per 100 possessions when its three supposed stars, DeMar DeRozan, Zach LaVine, and Nikola Vucevic, were all on the floor, and that mark dips even further when the trio plays without Lonzo Ball, who's missing another season with a leg injury. The Bulls entering the season were, with all three, made little to no sense, but they've quietly started to bounce back since LaVine left the rotation with a foot injury, which may not do wonders for his trade value, but it could bolster the market for DeRozan and Vucevic, perhaps. On the heels of this run, it's easy to pass the Bulls, but keeping the grade there will depend on whether they actually cash in on any of that value before February and where they ultimately end up. Next up, the Cleveland Cavaliers. I'll give them a B-. The Cleveland Cavaliers are getting what may feel like a relatively conservative B-, based mostly on the fact that they just have not been as good as they were last season. Injuries have had their impact on that conclusion, though. The lineup of Darius Garland, who just fractured his jaw, actually, Donovan Mitchell, Max Strus, Evan Mobley, and Jared Allen. Evan Mobley's getting left knee surgery as well. Both of those reports came out today. Jared Allen as well has only played, that lineup has only played 304 non-garbage time possessions together. If everyone can get and stay healthy, which is a huge if, the team's overall point differential should climb. On the bright side, even with the injuries, a few things are undoubtedly working. The team's net rating is comfortably better when either of the star guards, Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland, is on the floor, and those two are averaging a combined 47.2 points and 11.5 assists. And this summer's most notable addition from the Miami Heat, Max Strus, is clearly working. He's averaging over 14 points and a career-high 4 assists while trailing only Donovan Mitchell in threes per game and hitting his at an above-average rate. So the Cavs look like a playoff team, no doubt. Next up, the Dallas Mavericks. I'll give them a solid flat B. We sort of take this production for granted, his production for granted at this point, but Luka Doncic is averaging 31.9 points, 8.7 assists, 8.4 rebounds, and 3.9 threes. He's also shooting a career-high 38.2% from three. Those are outrageously good numbers and a big part of why the Mavericks are currently above 500. Kyrie Irving has been a supplementary offensive player. That's quite a luxury to have as well. He's among the most talented players in the NBA on that end of the floor, and he's willingly accepted a number two role behind Luka Doncic to the tune of 23 points, over 5 assists, and 2.5 threes a game. Tim Hardaway Jr. deserves a mention for his shooting and six-man of the year level contributions as well, but the roster sort of falls off after that, at least from a statistical perspective. That probably shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. Most of the players are at or near preseason expectations, but the Mavs would have needed a couple of the role players to smash those to be in the A range right about now. Next up, the Denver Nuggets. They've been pretty mid. I'll give them a C, the defending champions. I'll give them a C. Coming off an NBA championship, the Denver Nuggets looked like an absolute juggernaut during an 8-1 start to the season, but they're a mildly alarming 6-8 since then. Jamal Murray missing time with both hamstring and ankle injuries has certainly contributed to that fact. But ever since his return, whatever aura the champs may have built up during last season's playoffs seems to be missing. The Nuggets are outside the top 10 in both offense and defense and near the middle of the league in net rating. Of course, reigning finals MVP Nikola Jokic is averaging an absurd 28.4 points, 13 rebounds, and 9.6 assists. But even his scoring efficiency, while still above average, has fallen off a cliff when compared to his own, you know, I would say otherworldly standard. This all might simply be a case of the defending champions not taking the regular season as seriously as others. That's possible. Heck, the Nuggets were sort of guilty of that toward the end of last season before they ultimately won the championship. But all things considered, the rubric demands a little more of a contender to get anywhere near an A. The Detroit Pistons, obviously an F. This felt like the year that the Detroit Pistons' young Cade Cunningham-led core might make a leap. That did not happen. That did not mean anyone was guaranteeing playoff or even play-in contention. It just seemed there was enough seasoning for Cade Cunningham, Jalen Duren, Jaden Ivey, and the rest of the young core to at least be competitive. That was probably why the team made such a massive investment in new coach Monty Williams and surrounding Cunningham with more shooting by bringing in Joe Harris, the former Brooklyn Net. And I still don't think that paying Monty Williams that much money was dumb. I mean, I think when the Pistons come around player-wise, you know, they'll be a playoff team with Monty at the helm for sure at some point. I'm just not sure when that will be. So a quarter of the way into the season, Cunningham can't stop missing shots and turning the ball over. Williams can't decide if he even wants to play Ivy, and the Pistons are on a 19-game losing streak. 19-game losing streak. Even in the first year of Williams' contract, the panic button is getting tempting, but I don't think they will ultimately press it. Next up, the Golden State Warriors. I'll give them a C-. They're a bit of a mess right now. A realistic preseason assessment of the Golden State Warriors would have taken age and a lack of size into consideration and probably pegged them as a back half of the Western Conference playoff team. But it's actually been worse than that. A day after the in-season tournament, Golden State is a game and a half back of 10th place and a spot in the play-in. The lineup the Warriors hung their hats on last season, Stephen Curry, Klay Thompson, Andrew Wiggins, Draymond Green, and Kevon Looney, is a concerning minus 8.3 points per 100 possessions. Klay is averaging 15.8 points with a below-average three-point percentage. Never thought I'd see that day that that happens. And Wiggins is an alarming 27.7% from three, so that's absolutely horrible. Steph Curry is a perpetual silver lining, but the only other ones on the roster that might all be, you know, that have been good or on the bench. Chris Paul is having his own shooting woes, but he has the second unit as organized as it's ever been during the Curry era. Dario Saric has quietly been a good backup five, probably even better than Kevon Looney, if we're being honest. And Brandon Podzimski looks like he'll eventually be a productive NBA player. He was the Warriors' first-round pick in this year's NBA draft. Altogether, though, this season, more than any in recent memory, has to give Warriors fans wondering where they're going to go from here. Houston Rockets. Talk about a team that was a bottom feeder, and now look at them. I'll give them a very, very good B+. There was plenty of reason for optimism for the Houston Rockets following this summer. Alperen Sengun seemed primed for a breakout season, and veteran additions like Fred VanVleet and Dylan Brooks made sense as pressure releases for Jalen Green, you know, the youngsters, and Jabari Smith Jr. But even those with the most rose-colored outlook on this team would probably have to admit that they've exceeded expectations still. Sengun is averaging a young Jokic-like 20.8 points, 9.1 rebounds, and 5.7 assists. And when he's on the floor with the other four aforementioned starters, Houston is a plus 11.2 points per 100 possessions. The only thing that's holding the Rockets back from getting an A is their abysmal record on the road, which is currently 1-8. But even that dam might be on the verge of breaking. Last week, they handed the defending champion and aforementioned Denver Nuggets their first loss at Ball Arena. Next up, the Indiana Pacers. They have been balling out. I'll give them a B+. The Indiana Pacers are on pace to set the single-season record for points per game. That's nuts. And Tyrese Halliburton is third in Basketball Reference's MVP tracker, which is based on a model built using previous voting results, with unprecedented averages of 26.9 points and 12.1 assists. Absolutely unreal. With the best guard in the league as of right now, orchestrating the attack and distributing the basketball to shooters like Buddy Hield, Miles Turner, and Aaron Nesmith, the Pacers' first quarter of the season has been an almost unqualified success. Of course, the qualification is that they're also on pace to allow the fifth most points per game to opponents in league history. This year's Washington Wizards are somehow worse in that category. Indiana is a fun, explosive, and young, lightning-fast team, but it's also shockingly unconcerned and bad on defense. Next up, the Los Angeles Clippers. I'll give them a B-. The Los Angeles Clippers graduated from underwhelming to disappointing after they lost James Harden's first five games with the team. And while they're still only a game over 500, it's safe to say that they're figuring out this new arrangement with a ball-dominant guard alongside Kawhi Leonard and Paul George. Since those first five Harden games, the Clippers are 8-3, which is very, very good, obviously. And in that stretch, the stars have found a pretty good balance. Kawhi Leonard in that 11-game stretch is averaging over 24 points, 3.5 assists, over 2 threes, and shooting 41.1% from 3. Paul George, 22.2 points, over 4 assists, 3.3 threes, and shooting 39% from 3. And the aforementioned James Harden, 16 points, 8 assists, 2.5 threes, and 42% from 3. Very solid. With that trio now clicking and the Clippers maintaining a top 5 defense with guys like Ivica Zubac, this team suddenly looks like a championship contender yet again. They just have to sustain this level for a bit longer to push into that B+ to A range. Next up, the Los Angeles Lakers are also, they are B+. Clippers are B-, Lakers are B+. The winners of the NBA's first ever in-season tournament barely missed out on a first quarter A because of a slow start and some lingering questions about the team's health and injury concerns. They've already had a good chunk of games missed by Rui Hachimura, Jared Vanderbilt, and Gabe Vincent, and if soon-to-be 39-year-old LeBron James is, you know, injured, or the often-injured Anthony Davis goes down for any length of time, the roster will be stretched thin. But honestly, that's a little nitpicky right now. The Lakers went 7-0 in the in-season tournament and beat the Indiana Pacers in convincing fashion in the championship game. Even with the slow start, the Lakers are top 10 in defense and above average in net rating, and somehow LeBron is at an 8.8 box plus minus, which would be his highest mark since 2015-16. Unprecedented what he's doing. If this team is whole in April and May, they obviously are a bona fide championship contender. Next up, the Memphis Grizzlies. I'll give them a C. All things considered, the Memphis Grizzlies have survived Ja Morant's 25-game suspension, which ends this month, and a terrible luck with injuries about as well as anyone could have expected. Yes, they're way below 500, and they have one of the worst net ratings in the NBA, but they're also just 5 games back of 10th place, which would give them a spot in the play-in with around 3/4 of the season to go. That's obviously not an easy climb, but it's not an impossible one either. With Ja Morant back, the playoffs will still be a huge possibility. And while Desmond Bane and Jaren Jackson Jr. get a lot of credit for that, the fringe NBA players who've stepped up in the wake of all the injuries might deserve a little more, and those are Vince Williams Jr., Kenneth Lofton Jr., Derrick Rose, and Jalen Noel. Pretty crazy to refer to Derrick Rose as a fringe NBA player, but here we are. It's 2023, almost 2024. They are the only Grizzlies with positive raw plus minuses. Next up, the Miami Heat, who made the NBA Finals last season. I'll give them a B minus. The Miami Heat have a non-garbage time point differential just below zero for the season. And after he missed most of the playoff run that ended in the 2023 Finals, the team continuing to be better without Tyler Hero on the floor is mildly concerning. But relative to preseason expectations, which still featured plenty of skies falling takes with about losing Max Strus and Gabe Vincent and not landing Damian Lillard, Miami has had a solid season. When Jimmy Butler, Bam Adebayo, and a seemingly rejuvenated Kyle Lowry are all on the floor, the Heat are plus 6.5 points per 100 possessions. And they have gotten a steal in the draft who could prove better than either Strus or Vincent in Jaime Jaquez Jr. I'm very familiar with him. He played his college ball at UCLA. I wish the Lakers drafted him. Over his last 9 games, the rookie forward is putting up 17 points, over 3 assists, and 1.5 threes, while shooting 45% from 3. Oh my god, that is so good. 45% from 3. Jaime Jaquez Jr. representing Mexico. Next up, the Milwaukee Bucks. I'll give them a very solid or very respectable B+. The Milwaukee Bucks have to be among the most scrutinized second place teams we've ever seen. Over the first quarter of the season, they've been a lightning rod for almost constant discussion about their defense and the shortcomings of first-year head coach Adrian Griffin. But they're also on pace for 56 wins, developing chemistry between Damian Lillard, the aforementioned, and Giannis Antetokounmpo on the fly and dominating opponents in the clutch, defined by the league as the last 5 minutes of games within 5 points. The Bucks have the second-best clutch net rating, and Lillard is averaging 43.9 points, 6.4 assists, and 4.4 threes per 75 clutch possessions. Milwaukee now has one of the most dominant interior scorers of all time to deal body blows to opponents for the first 43 to 44 minutes of every game before turning it over to Damian Lillard, Dame Dalla, for the knockout punches. The fact that this team is still in the developing phase of its current build should terrify the rest of the NBA. Next up, arguably the biggest surprise of this season, the Minnesota Timberwolves, the first A+ on this list. The only A+ of this exercise was reserved for the Minnesota Timberwolves, who steamrolled their way to the league's best record with a combination of size and defense that looks unmatchable right now. Around 12 months after seemingly every NBA fan and analyst had a chance to skewer the Rudy Gobert trade as laughably bad, he looks like a defensive system onto himself again and is the odds-on favorite to win his fourth Defensive Player of the Year. The fit between he and Karl-Anthony Towns is nowhere near as clunky as it was last season, thanks in large part to Mike Conley rather than D'Angelo Russell organizing things on offense. Of course, Mike Conley and Rudy Gobert were also teammates previously with the Utah Jazz. Jaden McDaniels continues to look like an all-defensive level perimeter defender who can occasionally get hot enough to swing a game on the other end of the floor. And Naz Reid, despite the award typically going to guards, should be in the mix for Sixth Man of the Year with his scoring and energy off the bench. The biggest reason for this breakout, though, is likely Anthony Edwards, whose game is rounding out as he becomes a legitimate superstar in the NBA. Edwards is 24.4 points per game, is slightly lower than last season's average, but he's working on meaningful improvements in scoring efficiency, assist percentage, and defensive consistency. If he stays around All-NBA level through the postseason, Minnesota has a real chance to make the NBA Finals, in my opinion. Next up, we got the New Orleans Pelicans. I'll give them a C-. Inconsistency has been the name of the game for this season's Pelicans, who were embarrassed by the Los Angeles Lakers in the semifinals of the in-season tournament. Zion Williamson specifically seemed almost invisible for most of the 44-point loss, and his commitment, or a potential lack thereof, came under fire afterward. On talent alone, Zion is good enough to be an MVP candidate. We saw it as recently as 12 months ago, but he doesn't look nearly as explosive this season. And his seeming indifference has been a factor in several losses this season for the Pelicans. On the other hand, though, New Orleans is loaded with highly switchable defenders, shooting and shot creation. Brandon Ingram and CJ McCollum have both looked like all-stars at various points this year. If the Pelicans can just find a way to maintain focus for extended periods of time, this season can still feel more successful than it does right now when they're barely above 500 and hanging on to a bottom 10 net rating. Next up, the New York Knicks. I'll give them a solid B. Being the New York Knicks means this team will generally be the target of increased scrutiny and expectations. Seemingly every loss is analyzed under a microscope. Every shooting slump from Julius Randle or RJ Barrett is potentially blown out of proportion. But a sober view of the Knicks' first quarter of this season reveals that they're doing just fine. Honestly, the Knicks might be even better than that. They're in the top 10 of offensive, defensive, and net rating. Jalen Brunson is playing like an absolute star, averaging 25 points, 5.5 assists, and 3 threes a game. Emmanuel Quickley is a sixth man of the year candidate, no doubt. And even RJ Barrett is posting an above-average three-point percentage, believe it or not. It may be tough to justify them among the East's, you know, biggest championship contenders, but if you could have expected that coming into this season, you know, anyway. New York is going to finish near 50 wins. They could get more than 50 potentially and be a tough team to face in the playoffs. Given the roster, that would be a solid outcome for them. Next up, the Oklahoma City Thunder. From zeros to heroes, they get an A. Plenty predicted or expected something of a breakout from the Oklahoma City Thunder this season, but they've still somehow exceeded expectations through 20 games and change. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is obviously an MVP candidate whose numbers should raise some eyebrows even in this era of a hyper-productive superstar. He's putting up an absurd, in any era, 30.5 points, 6.2 assists, and 2.8 steals. He's almost averaging 3 steals a game. That is absurd. And he has a way above average true shooting percentage. When Chet Holmgren's 3 and D game and Isaiah Joe's outside shooting are on the floor with SGA, OKC dominates opponents. Only the Boston Celtics and Minnesota Timberwolves have trios with a higher raw plus-minus. You add Jalen Williams' secondary creation and better-than-expected contributions from Case and Wallace, and you get one of the league's youngest teams in contention for first place in the Western Conference. Speaking of young teams, the Orlando Magic, they also get an A. As there was for the Oklahoma City Thunder, there was writing on the wall for an Orlando Magic breakout this season. After a 5-20 start last season, they were over 500 for the last 57 games of that season. Internal development for Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner alone would have been enough for them to at least clear their preseason over-under of 36.5 wins. Well, a quarter of the way into the season, they are tied for second place in the East and on pace for 56 wins. Banchero's scoring efficiency has skyrocketed from where it was in his rookie season. Wagner is warming up after a cold shooting start. Jalen Suggs is a defensive nightmare. He's like a mini SGA as far as steals go. Jonathan Isaac has finally returned from various injuries to provide his own all-defensive level combination contributions. Cole Anthony is a sixth man of the year candidate, and the team has generally just gelled in a way that even the highest optimist couldn't have imagined fully. Next up, the Philadelphia 76ers get an A-. A bit like the Denver Nuggets, the Sixers are not playing quite as well as they were during an 8-1 start, but their cold stretch has not led to as many questions. In fact, the 76ers are fairly easy to figure out. Their top 5 net rating is largely the product of the dynamic 1-2 punch of Joel Embiid and Tyrese Maxey, who are 1st and 23rd respectively in free throw attempts per game. When both are on the floor, the Sixers have a plus 8.2 points per 100 possessions, but the supporting cast deserves some love as well. With James Harden gone and a new coach Nick Nurse in place, the ball moves from side to side within possessions far better than it did last season. That has players like Tobias Harris and DeAnthony Melton looking more engaged, dedicated, and then you have dedicated defense from new additions like Nicholas Batum, Robert Covington, Kelly Oubre Jr., and Patrick Beverley is helping as well. 3 out of those 4 are former Clippers, should be noted. The Sixers may not have gotten a star back in the Harden deal, but the roster is deeper and better balanced than it was last season. Next up, the Phoenix Suns, they get a B+. Injuries have been a constant for the 2023-24 Phoenix Suns. Kevin Durant has missed 3 games, Devin Booker has missed 9, and Bradley Beal has missed 19. But that had to have been expected by most before this season even started. All 3 stars have dealt with durability issues in recent seasons, and they'll likely deal with more prior to the end of this one. Hopefully not. Being where they are in spite of that is actually pretty impressive. Right now, the Suns are in the play-in mix, which certainly isn't where their fans or front office want to be. But KD is averaging 31 points and almost 6 assists while shooting an even 50% from 3. The Booker at point guard experiment is undoubtedly working. He's averaging 27.5 points and over 8 assists a game. And the hodgepodge supporting cast, mostly assembled after the Bradley Beal trade, is getting better than replacement-level contributions, at least according to Box Plus Minus from Yusuf Nurkic, Jordan Goodwin, Eric Gordon, Nasir Little, and Grayson Allen, to name a few. Beal is set to return this week, so that is huge for the Suns. Next up, the Portland Trailblazers. It's way too early to panic, but it's also late enough to at least mention Scoot Henderson's struggles. He's averaging only 9.3 points on 10.7 field goal attempts, 4.1 assists, and 3.3 turnovers. And among the 981 players in the last 20 years to log at least 100 minutes in their first 12 NBA games, Henderson's minus 11.5 box plus minus ranks 978th out of 981. That is, Jesus, that is abysmal. Again, there's plenty of time to turn things around, but some of the names near his on that list are Kevin Serafin, Anthony Bennett, and Paul Zipser. Other than that, though, there are actually some reasons for optimism about this rebuild. Jeremy Grant's 22.1 points should be helping his trade value. Malcolm Brogdon putting up 17 points and over six assists a game could be doing the same for him. And 20-year-old Shaedon Sharpe averaging 18.5 points, 3.5 assists, and over two threes a game in only his second season is plenty encouraging. Next up, the Sacramento Kings, who would have thought they get a B. The Sacramento Kings have a sub-zero net rating, but they're on pace for 49 wins, one better than last season, and their two best players look like all-stars for the second year in a row. In fact, De'Aaron Fox is playing better than he ever has. He's in his seventh year. That is fucking insane. I remember when he was playing for the University of Kentucky, you know, dueling with Lonzo Ball from UCLA in 2017. It really has been 7 years. Wow, time fucking flies. It's crazy. Anyway, Fox is averaging 30.5 points and 6.5 assists while posting a career high of box plus minus, so he's elite, obviously. Domantas Sabonis, meanwhile, is averaging a steady 18.8 points, 12.2 rebounds, and 7 assists a game. A meaningful jump toward contention might require the same for Keegan Murray. An upgrade over Harrison Barnes might be in order as well. But after almost two decades of losing, back-to-back seasons around 50 wins would have to feel like a massive success for the Kings and their fans. Next up, Wemby and the San Antonio Spurs, they get a D. No one expected the San Antonio Spurs to compete for a title this season or even be close to that. Most probably didn't even imagine them in the mix for the play-in tournament, but a 3-18 start to Victor Wembanyama's career is disappointing, especially when it seems largely avoidable. San Antonio has persisted with this Jeremy Sochan as a lead playmaker experiment at the expense of their number one pick. If the Spurs wind up being right, they'll have tons of size and versatility in their long-term backcourt. If they're wrong, it may feel like they squandered, at least to some degree, Wemby's rookie season. When Wembanyama and Sochan are on the floor without Trey Jones, San Antonio is a nightmarishly bad negative 22.9 points per 100 possessions. When Wembanyama plays with Jones, an unspectacular point guard, but a point guard nonetheless, the Spurs are plus 9.8, so a massive difference. I'm not sure what Popovich is thinking, why he so desperately wants Sochan to be a point guard. There's no guarantee that those numbers would hold with more minutes for the latter duo, but it's starting to feel like San Antonio is flat out punting on the opportunity to get Wemby competitive, you know, reps in competitive games. Of course, that may be the unstated goal. Another high lottery pick to pair with Wemby could prove useful in the long run, but right now it's hard to blindly excuse what's happening with this team. Toronto Raptors next up. The Toronto Raptors situation feels very similar to that of the Chicago Bulls, though maybe it's not quite as severe. Scottie Barnes, OG Anunoby, and Pascal Siakam are collectively younger than Zach LaVine, DeMar DeRozan, and Nikola Vucevic, but their fit alongside one another feels wonky at best. Ideally, Barnes would be a lead playmaker surrounded by as much shooting as possible. And while Anunoby seems to fit that bill, Siakam certainly does not. That and a sub-500 record may have the Raptors thinking about breaking this whole thing up. According to The Athletic, Toronto has left teams believing that now more than ever, either Siakam or Anunoby could be traded by the February 8th deadline. Depending on the return, such moves could actually make the Raptors worse in the short term, while better setting them up for long-term success. Next up, the Utah Jazz. We're almost done. We got two more. They get a C-. The Utah Jazz are nowhere near as competitive as they were at the start of the first year of this rebuild. On balance, they may be getting the worst guard play in the NBA this season, and they haven't been getting on-court reps for first-round picks Bryce Sensabaugh and Taylor Hendricks. Injuries to Walker Kessler and Lauri Markkanen give this team a bit of a pass on some of the above, but it's getting increasingly difficult to understand not playing the rookies, especially when Keontae George has been starting at the point since early November. The justification may be wanting to present themselves as a playoff contender for Markkanen, who will be a free agent in 2025. But that facade is falling fast as the Jazz have a bottom five net rating. They're not much worse than where realistic expectations may have had them prior to this season, but still. And lastly, this might be the worst team of all, the Washington Wizards. They obviously get an F. Some may quibble over the Washington Wizards being the only team to receive a failing grade here. After all, trading Kristaps Porzingis and Bradley Beal this offseason makes it easy to identify them as another rebuilding team. They come in below a D because even after these moves, there should have been enough talent and experience here to at least make opponents sweat a little bit. Tyus Jones has been one of the game's best backup point guards for years.
Jordan Poole and Kyle Kuzma are both NBA champions who have 20-point-per-game seasons under their belts. Daniel Gafford is a solid rim runner and protector. And there's an interesting combination of youth, size, and defensive versatility at the forward spots in Denny Avdija, Corey Kispert, and Bilal Coulibaly. Somehow, all of this has gelled into what seems like the worst possible version of this roster. Washington is last in points per game at 22nd, and 22nd in three-point percentage. Poole is tied for last in wins above replacement, the cumulative version of box plus minus, and the Wizards are a dismal 3-18. So there you have it. Those are my ratings. That took a while. That took 30 minutes. Wow. Those are my ratings for every NBA team. And with that, we are now going to transition to some baseball, shall we? The Bronx has a new number 22 roaming the outfield. The New York Yankees announced that Juan Soto will wear number 22 with the team for the 2024 season after they acquired him from the San Diego Padres. This should come as no surprise given the fact that Soto has worn number 22 with the Nationals, the Padres, and now the Yankees. This should come as no surprise given the fact that Soto has worn 22. Like I said, Harrison Bader last wore 22 for the Yankees before being waived midway through last season, so there's no issue there. New York traded pitchers Michael King, Drew Thorpe, Johnny Brito, and Randy Vasquez, and catcher Kyle Higashioka to the Padres for Soto and Trent Grisham earlier this month. The blockbuster trade was a long time coming, with the Yankees long thought to be the favorite to land Soto as the Padres look to shed payroll. The move is not without risk, as Soto can become a free agent at the end of this season. Soto's agent Scott Boras almost always takes his clients to free agency to extract the best possible contract. And Shohei Ohtani's 10-year, $700 million mega deal with the Dodgers may have forever altered baseball's contractual structure. Even after learning of Ohtani's historic deferments, the starting price for Soto is almost certainly more than $500 million at this point. Quote, "The culture we have with the Yankees that we project constantly is our intent to win," GM Brian Cashman told reporters last week. "We're here, we're in it to win it." So that's messaging that's constantly being reinforced. So I think that's a recruiting beacon for anybody. I know the question is specifically about Juan Soto, but I think we certainly want to try to always, under the Steinbrenner leadership, to make this the mecca of baseball. Soto will have quite a bit to live up to in wearing number 22 for the Yankees. Robinson Cano, Roger Clemens, Jimmy Key, Ali Reynolds, and Marius Russo have all made the All-Star team wearing number 22 for the New York Yankees. With that, let us now talk about some more MLB free agency. Japanese pitcher Shota Imanaga is reportedly drawing interest from the Los Angeles Dodgers, New York Mets, Boston Red Sox, and Chicago Cubs. Interesting to not see the Yankees interested. John Morosi of MLB Network, who shall not be trusted, reported that Imanaga's contract could reach $20 million in annual salary. The 30-year-old won gold for Japan alongside Shohei Ohtani at the 2023 World Baseball Classic. He's one of two Japanese pitchers posted this offseason alongside, of course, Yoshinobu Yamamoto. Yamamoto is considered perhaps the best pitcher remaining in all of the 2023 free agent class, while Imanaga is more of a late rotation talent, who is still elite. The lefty has made two All-Star teams and was the 2023 Central League strikeout leader for the Yokohama Dina Bay Stars. He was teammates with Trevor Bauer. His stuff is not considered overpowering, but he has quality command and a very high pitching IQ, much like Clayton Kershaw. The Dodgers remain in the market for a starting pitcher even after signing Ohtani because he will not be able to pitch in 2024. He will be ready to pitch in 2025. The historic deferments on Ohtani's contract will also make adding payroll more palatable for Dodgers ownership. The Mets, Red Sox, and Cubs are all big market clubs that have been linked to several starters throughout the free agency period. They just have to start acting and, you know, not just be interested. With that, let us now transition to some NFL. This is very cool. Shout out my friend Lucas. The NFL is reportedly headed to South America. According to CBS Sports, the league is expected to reveal Wednesday that it plans on hosting a game in Brazil in the 2024 season. It was noted that the NFL also considered Spain but chose Brazil for the game instead. Playing internationally is nothing new for the NFL at this point after they launched their international series in 2007 with the game between the New York Giants and Miami Dolphins in London, England. In September, NFL Executive Vice President Peter O'Reilly confirmed to the Associated Press that the league was exploring Spain and Brazil as possibilities and even visited stadium sites in Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo in Brazil and Madrid in Spain. Quote, "There is passion and demand for our game and for the NFL outside the U.S., and that's why we're exploring it as fully as we are." This comes after the league hosted five international games this season and three happening in London and two happening in Germany. The Jacksonville Jaguars played two consecutive games in London, which was an NFL first. In 2022, the NFL launched its International Home Marketing Areas, IHMA, initiative,
which assigned different teams to different international countries. The teams were given the ability to increase marketing and fan engagement in those countries in an effort to further grow the game across the globe. The Dolphins were the first team assigned to Brazil, while the Dolphins and Chicago Bears were assigned to Spain. Dolphins versus Los Angeles Rams game would go absolutely insane in Brazil. Miami played in one of the games in Germany this year and lost to the Kansas City Chiefs. So there you have that. Now let's talk about some hockey. I mean, we don't talk about hockey that much on this show, but we will. We will talk about it right now. The St. Louis Blues announced Tuesday night that they fired Craig Berube after parts of six seasons as the team's head coach. General manager Doug Armstrong added that Drew Bannister, who is the head coach of the Blues AHL affiliate in the Springfield Thunderbirds, will serve as the St. Louis Blues interim head coach. Berube, who led the Blues to their first Stanley Cup title in franchise history in 2019, had St. Louis off to a 13-14-1 start this season, placing it 6th out of 8 teams in the Western Conference's Central Division. The decision to fire Berube came after a 6-4 loss to the Detroit Red Wings on Tuesday, which marked his 4th consecutive loss with the Blues. Berube went 75-58-28 in two seasons as the Flyers head coach from 2013 to 2015, but his next head coaching opportunity did not come until 2018-19 when he replaced Mike Yao 19 games into the season. After taking over, Berube went 38-19-6 and led the Blues on a deep playoff run, culminating in their first ever and their only Stanley Cup championship win. Berube took the Blues back to the playoffs in each of the next three seasons as well, but they were unable to get past the second round. Last season marked the first time in the Blues that Blues missed the playoffs under his tenure, finishing 37-38-7, and they were on pace to miss the playoffs this season before his dismissal. Overall, he went 206-132-44 in 382 regular season games and as the Blues head coach, and 24-27 in 51 playoff games. Prior to his coaching days, the 57-year-old Berube spent 16 seasons in the NHL as a forward. His replacement, Bannister, is also a former NHL player, playing 6 years in the league as a defenseman. The 49-year-old Bannister is 93-58-19 as an AHL head coach, leading the Thunderbirds to back-to-back playoff appearances, including a trip to the Calder Cup final in 2022. So, yeah, good move for the Blues, in my opinion. Let's switch gears. Let's switch gears. One second, having some technical difficulties here. Let's switch gears back to some baseball. The San Francisco Giants finally made their first major move in a while on Tuesday. According to John Heyman, center fielder Jung-Hoo Lee agreed to a 6-year deal with the Giants for $113 million. The deal includes an opt-out after four seasons as well. Lee was posted by the Kiwoom Heroes earlier this month, and he starred in the Korean baseball organization in recent years. Bob Nightingale of USA Today reported the Giants were not the only team interested. The Toronto Blue Jays, Chicago Cubs, and San Diego Padres all had expressed interest, strong interest in Jung-Hoo Lee before he signed with the Giants. Center fielder slash first baseman Cody Bellinger now squarely on those teams' radar, along with the Giants as well. The Giants are playing catch-up to the rival Los Angeles Dodgers, considering they have won the National League West in 10 of the past 11 seasons and just added arguably the best player of all time in Shohei Ohtani. Lee may not be as talented as Ohtani, but he can help the Giants close the gap if he plays like he did in the KBO. That's a big question mark, though. He was the Rookie of the Year in 2017 and then won the MVP in 2022 with a .349 batting average, .421 on-base percentage, and .575 slugging, 23 homers, and 113 RBIs. I guess that's why he signed for $113 million, 113 RBIs in his MVP season in the KBO. Hitting for average has never been a concern, but it marked the first time that he launched more than 15 home runs in a season. Adding that type of power to his approach made Lee all the more dangerous at the plate entering the 2023 season. Throwing his .429 batting average for the South Korea in the World Baseball Classic, and he figured to be on the verge of another dominant season. However, his 2023 season was cut short after he suffered a broken left ankle in July. He was still productive, though, and was slashing .318, .406, .455 with 6 homers and 45 RBIs at the time of his injury setback. Lee is only 25 years old, too, and he's one of the best contact hitters available this offseason. He hit better than .300 in all 7 of his seasons in the KBO, which is very impressive, and he should help anchor the Giants lineup in 2024, even as he adjusts to life in a new league on a different continent. San Francisco likely needs to add more pieces to try to compete with the Dodgers, but as a Dodger fan, I will admit that this was a huge move for them. Switching gears back to the NFL, if you were holding a ticket for Zach Wilson and Tommy DeVito to be named AFC and NFC Player of the Week at some point this season, congratulations are definitely in order. The NFL announced on Wednesday that the quarterbacks for the New York Jets and New York Giants were named the AFC and NFC Players of the Week, respectively, for Week 14. given how many injuries have hit the quarterback position this season, it's not a surprise to see how many unexpected players have been awarded players of the week recently. That includes Jake Browning, Josh Dobbs, Kyren Williams, Devin Singletary, Tommy DeVito, and now Zach Wilson. Pretty crazy list, honestly. Last week was certainly an eventful journey for Wilson. It began with a report from The Athletic that the Jets wanted to go back to Zach Wilson after starting Tim Boyle in the previous two games, but the 24-year-old was, quote, reluctant to do it. Wilson and head coach Robert Saleh both denied the report, and the third-year quarterback was eventually named the starter for Week 14 against the Houston Texans. He responded with arguably the best game, definitely the best game of his career, going 27 of 36 for 301 yards and two touchdowns in the 30-6 win. Where was this earlier? The 30 points were the most that were more than the Jets had scored in the previous three games combined, which was 27. They also snapped a season-long five-game losing streak in the process. DeVito is turning into one of the best stories of the entire NFL season. The 25-year-old undrafted free agent made his first appearance in Week 8 against the Jets when Tyrod Taylor suffered a rib injury. After Daniel Jones' season ended with a torn ACL the following week against the Las Vegas Raiders, DeVito became the Giants' starting quarterback. He's led the team to three straight wins, including Monday's 24-22 victory over the Green Bay Packers, which is huge for the Rams to shut out Tommy DeVito. He went 17 of 21 for 158 yards and a touchdown through the air. He also had 71 rushing yards on 10 carries. The Illinois alum led the offense 47 yards on the final drive to set up Randy Bullock's game-winning 37-yard field goal as time expired. So he has been absolutely huge for the Giants, as has, you know, just like Zach Wilson has been for the Jets. The Washington Wizards and Washington Capitals have called Washington, D.C. their home since December 1997, but a move to Northern Virginia may be on the horizon. Ted Leonisis made the announcement Wednesday detailing a, quote, new 9 million square foot entertainment district that would house an arena for both teams, per NBC4 Washington. They would move from downtown D.C. to Potomac Yard in Alexandria, Virginia. Woj of ESPN first reported the plans on Tuesday. Washington, D.C. is not giving up the teams without a fight, however, with Mayor Muriel Bowser introducing a plan for legislation on Tuesday night that would, quote, provide financing of $500 million toward the $800 million renovation project over a period of 3 years beginning in 2024. Woj recently, he notably cited a report from the Washington Business Journal, who wrote the following on Tuesday regarding a big step that took place for a move to occur. That potential move took a big step toward reality Monday when a panel of Virginia lawmakers unanimously approved the plan to lure the monumental sports and entertainment-owned teams to Northern Virginia. State and Alexandria officials are planning a media event Wednesday morning at the Potomac Yard Metro Station, where tents have been erected. Leonisis is the founder, chairman, and CEO of Monumental Sports and Entertainment, which owns the Washington Wizards, Washington Capitals, and Washington Mystics as well. The Wizards and Capitals currently play downtown in Capital One Arena and have done so since 1997 when it opened as the MCI Center. Previously, the two franchises called Landover, Maryland home beginning in the mid-1970s. The Mystics, who play at Entertainment and Sports Arena in Southeast D.C., are not reported to be part of the potential move to Northern Virginia. On the D.C. side, there's obvious concern about the financial impact of losing both of the teams. Quote, D.C. officials know both the financial and symbolic impact of losing the teams and are negotiating with Leonisis to provide a financial package that would convince him to stay at Gallery Place, where Monumental owns the arena and the city owns the land. The company could get out of the land lease with certain maneuvering as soon as 2027. Per the Monumental website, the arena has generated nearly $800 million in tax revenue for the district since opening its doors. Leonisis' Monumental and Sports Entertainment Group wants $600 million in public funding from Washington, D.C. to stick in the district, per the Washington Business Journal, for an $800 million revival of Capital One Arena. Per NBC4 Washington, Leonisis and Monumental can get out of the lease at the arena in 2027 if they pay off a roughly $36 million bond. Speaking of stadiums, let's talk about SoFi Stadium. It is absolutely magnificent. The Super Bowl is coming back to SoFi Stadium in Los Angeles. NFL owners unanimously voted to name the shared home of the Rams and Chargers as the host of Super Bowl 61 in February 2027. CBS Sports previously reported the league was expected to make the news official on Wednesday. Since the stadium opened in September 2020, it has hosted several major sports and pop culture events. It was the site of the 2023 College Football Playoff National Championship game between Georgia and TCU and WrestleMania 39 in April. It will also be one of the host cities for the 2026 FIFA World Cup and one of two venues alongside the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum hosting the 2028 Summer Olympics. SoFi Stadium hosted its first Super Bowl on February 13, 2022, when the hometown LA Rams played at home against the Cincinnati Bengals. The Rams won the game 23-20 on Cooper Kupp's one-yard touchdown reception with 1 minute 25 seconds left in the game. According to Jones, Los Angeles hosting the NFL's championship game in 2027 will coincide with the 60th anniversary of the first Super Bowl that was held at Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum on January 15th, 1967. Los Angeles and Southern California previously hosted the Super Bowl 8 times. Only Miami slash South Florida with 11 and New Orleans with 10 have hosted the game more. The 5-year turnaround for SoFi Stadium to host the game will be the second shortest in the 21st century. Hard Rock Stadium, home of the Miami Dolphins, had a 3-year gap between Super Bowls in 2007 and 2010. Let's talk about Shohei Ohtani a little bit. Just a little bit. We got to talk about Shohei. Two-way phenom Shohei Ohtani appears to have an opt-out in his contract with Los Angeles Dodgers after all. Ohtani can opt out of his record-setting 10-year, $700 million deal with the Dodgers if either majority owner Mark Walter or president of baseball operations Andrew Friedman lose their roles with the team, according to the Associated Press. The Athletic's Ken Rosenthal was the first to report that Ohtani could opt out of his contract with the Dodgers if there is, quote, specific change in Dodger personnel. I'm sure if they were to fire his personal translator, Ipe, that he would have an issue with that as well. The clause in Ohtani's contract could be the result of how things played out during his 6-year career with the Los Angeles Angels. The Halos fired general manager Billy Epler in September 2020 during Ohtani's third year in the Major League Baseball. Ohtani had a strong relationship with Epler, which was one of the reasons why he chose to sign with the Angels out of Japan in the first place. Given how the Angels have fared since Epler's departure, it is no surprise that Ohtani added a specific opt-out clause into his contract with the Dodgers. The Halos have not reached the playoffs famously, or I should say infamously, since 2014. Friedman has been the Dodgers since 2015, and he has molded the team into a perennial playoff championship contender with the acquisitions of players like Mookie Betts and the signings of star players like Ohtani and obviously Freddie Freeman as well. That said, it's reasonable to believe Friedman will remain with the Dodgers for the foreseeable future, and while the Dodgers will continue to be a contender for years to come following the addition of Shohei Ohtani, the club may not be done adding this winter as they continue to be linked to a number of other free agents, including pitchers Yoshinobu Yamamoto, Blake Snell, Josh Hader. So that is the latest. Ohtani can opt out if he so chooses to. Now, let's talk about the Dodgers a little bit more. This guy is one of the best pitchers of all time. Clayton Kershaw is undecided on if he will return for a 17th season with the Los Angeles Dodgers. Kershaw discussed his playing future with AM 570 LA Sports on Wednesday, saying he's discussing a potential return, saying he's undergoing shoulder surgery in November, or after he had the surgery in November, I should say. He is not expected to be able to pitch until the summer if he does return. Quote, "I'm excited to get back after the surgery and throw a ball and have it not hurt," Kershaw said. Kershaw went 13-5 with a 2.46 ERA and a 1.06 whip while striking out 137 batters in 131.1 innings. Last season, he made his 10th All-Star team but struggled down the stretch while dealing with shoulder issues. The Arizona Diamondbacks lit Kershaw up for 6 runs in 0.1 innings during Game 1 of the NLDS, marking his final appearance of 2023. Quote, "I think the competitor in me doesn't want it to end the way it did. I want to win. I want to win another World Series." He should have too. Kershaw has not pitched 30 games in a season since 2015, almost 10 years. He's dealt with a series of frustrating injuries that have limited his availability, though he's remained one of the sport's elite best pitchers when healthy still, even at his age. The Dodgers have been open about their desire to bring Kershaw back, and he would be a potential midseason boon to a rotation that struggled most of last season and struggled terribly in the playoffs. Let's transition back to the NBA now. Let's see. Back to the NBA. We got a couple more things and we're out of here. Golden State Warriors star Draymond Green has been suspended indefinitely for striking Phoenix Suns center Yusuf Nurkic in his team's 119-116 loss on December the 12th. Woj of ESPN was, of course, the first to report the news. Woj reported that Draymond is expected to receive counseling as part of the conditions for him to be able to return to the court. According to Bleacher Report, Green will be allowed to practice with the team during his suspension, but obviously he will not be able to play. At the very minimum, Draymond will save $519,555 toward the tax for every game that Golden State will save that much for every game that Draymond is suspended. He was assessed a flagrant 2 foul and ejected in the third quarter of the game after he swung his right arm and hit Nurkic in the face. The 4-time All-Star apologized after the game and said the blow was inadvertent, saying, quote, "I am not one to apologize for things I mean to do, but I do apologize to Yusuf because I did not intend to hit him." He told reporters, "I sell calls with my arms, so I was selling the call and I swung and unfortunately I hit him." However, it didn't help Draymond's case that he's a repeat offender across the NBA career, and this was already his third ejection of this season. In November, he drew a 5-game suspension after he placed Minnesota Timberwolves center Rudy Gobert in a headlock.
during a scuffle between the two teams. Speaking publicly for the first time after the incident, the 33-year-old said, quote, "I don't live my life with regrets," and alluded to conversations he had with team officials, also saying, "The consensus amongst all of us is that I'm going to be me no matter what. That's not going to change. But in saying that, there's always a better way that something can be done, so it's figuring out a better way. That's the consensus among all of us." After the Suns game, head coach Steve Kerr appeared to reference those discussions as well, but he seemed to strike a different tone. He emphasized Draymond's value to the team and said the veteran forward needs to, quote, "find a way to keep his poise on the court." Absolutely. There would be some past seasons in which Golden State could forge ahead with championship aspirations without Draymond Green for stretches at a time, but that time has since passed, and with the big three of he, Steph Curry, and Klay Thompson all into their mid-30s. The Warriors are 11th in the Western Conference with a record of 10-13. The end of their dynasty was prematurely forecast prior to the 2022 NBA playoffs, but now it looks like their championship window is finally closed for good. And with that, we will now talk about the Dodgers again, the evil empire, the evil fucking empire, the biggest story of this podcast episode. The Los Angeles Dodgers are cooking this offseason. The Tampa Bay Rays are trading starting pitcher Tyler Glasnow and outfielder Manuel Margot to the Dodgers, according to Jeff Passan of ESPN, in exchange for starting pitcher Ryan Pepiot and outfielder prospect Johnny DeLuca. Per that report, quote, "The deal is contingent on Glasnow signing a contract extension with Los Angeles, which the parties are hopeful will happen by Friday," sources familiar with the deal told ESPN. Glasnow is scheduled to make $25 million in 2024 before an extension would kick in. Given the Rays' general payroll approach and moneyball strategy, many wondered whether they would cash out now rather than risk losing him for a minimal return, a compensatory draft pick, if he declined the qualifying offer. Passan reported on November 14th that the Rays were, quote, "widely expected to move Glasnow." Quote, "A potential free agent of Glasnow's quality normally brings back quality prospects at the deadline, and that's without the possibility of draft pick compensation. The Rays then likely will drive a hard bargain, particularly because Glasnow's best days might be ahead of him. His elbow ligament first began failing in 2019. He avoided the injury list in the shortened 2020 season, but it will start next season, almost 3 years removed from his surgery in 2021. Even leaving the Tampa Bay Rays, typically thrifty spending aside, there was some curiosity as to whether a team trading for Glasnow might balk at giving him a big multi-year contract. The 30-year-old is unquestionably a top-end starter when he's healthy, but the health has been a consistent question. He has made 20-plus starts only once in his career, and he eclipsed 100 innings on two occasions. Glasnow didn't make his 2023 debut until a May 27 start against the Dodgers because of an oblique strain. Back spasms briefly took him out of the rotation later in the season as well. The right-hander was excellent when he did pitch, as he went 10-7 with a 3.53 ERA, a 2.9 FIP over 120 innings, and his 162 strikeouts were a career high. His best outing came in a 3-1 win over the Boston Red Sox on September 6th, in which he allowed one earned run on three hits and fanned 14 batters across six innings. Glasnow is a clear high-risk, high-reward addition for the Dodgers. Were he to navigate an entire season unscathed, or at least, you know, less injured than before, he'd likely be a strong Cy Young candidate. Since his trade to the Rays midway through the 2018 season, he sported a 3.2 ERA, 12.2 strikeouts per nine innings. From 2019 onwards, he is second among starters in FIP at 2.89 and fifth in WHIP at only 1.01 per Fangraphs. In an offseason that featured some notable free agents, this trade could be the most impactful move centered around a pitcher. Of course, you got Yoshinobu Yamamoto as well. Of course, that hinges on Glasnow dodging the injury trouble, no pun intended, that has dogged him for years, and that's far from a guarantee. Shohei Ohtani will eventually feature on the mound for the Dodgers, but that's unlikely to happen in 2024 thanks to his elbow surgery in the fall. The team needs more immediate reinforcements to rotation that saw Clayton Kershaw, Lance Lynn, and Julio Urias all hit free agency. Kershaw, who we just talked about, is a huge question mark. He's, I think, in my opinion, either going to come back or retire. I don't think he will sign with the Texas Rangers. I don't think it makes sense for them as defending World Series champions and for Kershaw. Lance Lynn has since signed with the St. Louis Cardinals, returning to the Cardinals after he was with them over 10 years ago. And Julio Urias hopefully goes to jail because he's a piece of shit wife beater. But this is a huge move for the Dodgers. And it came out today that the Dodgers will extend Glasnow. It will be for $135 million over 5 years. Let's do some quick math here. That is $27 million a year. That's solid. That's solid. So Ryan Pepiot, it sucks losing Ryan Pepiot a little bit, but it is what it is. Let's see. How are we doing on time? We have 7 minutes. So we're going to talk about this too. NFL, the Los Angeles Chargers got absolutely embarrassed last night. The Los Angeles Chargers have fired head coach Brandon Staley, former Rams defensive coordinator, and general manager Tom Telesco after the team's 5-9 start to this season. The Chargers also fired defensive run game coordinator and defensive line coach Jay Rogers after Staley and Telesco's exit as well. Outside linebackers coach Jeff Smith will replace Staley as the interim head coach, while JoJo Wooden has been named the interim GM. The Chargers' historic 63-21 loss to the Las Vegas Raiders on Thursday night was the last straw for the organization. Staley had been on the hot seat throughout this whole season, which featured numerous heartbreaking defeats, as always. It's Chargers football, just like Clippers basketball and Angels baseball. Five of the team's first six losses were decided by 3 points or less. That is absolutely brutal. Things only got worse once quarterback Justin Herbert was lost for the season due to a finger surgery, and the team's struggles led to a coaching change in the end. There had already been plenty of calls for Staley's job at the end of last season after an embarrassing first-round playoff loss where the Chargers blew a 27-0 lead to the Jacksonville Jaguars. They went 10-7 last season, earning the number 5 seed in the AFC, but they saw their season come to an end with a shocking 31-30 choke to the Jaguars in the wildcard round again after blowing a 27-0 lead. It was the third largest playoff collapse in the history of the NFL, larger than the 28-3 comeback by the Patriots in the Super Bowl in 2017, because that was obviously a 25-point game. This was a 27-point game. It was the second straight season that the Chargers were eliminated in very memorable fashion. In 2021, Los Angeles lost to the Las Vegas Raiders as time expired in overtime of their Week 18 game. A win or a tie would have gotten the Chargers to the playoffs, but a poorly timed timeout by, of course, none other than Brandon Staley, contributed to the eventual loss. Despite producing winning records in each of his first two years with the team, Staley was unable to reach expectations with an exciting roster of players like Herbert, Austin Eckler, Keenan Allen, and Joey Bosa. The defense has especially been a problem, and that's Staley's job. He's a defensive guy. It's been horrible, finishing 21st and 29th in the NFL in points allowed per game over the past 2 years. The unit ranks 27th this season, so horrible once again. Amid the struggles, Staley got angry at a reporter in Week 11 after questions about potentially giving up his defensive play calling. Telesco has been GM of the Chargers since 2013, when the team was still located in San Diego. Although he is responsible for drafting the likes of Keenan Allen, Joey Bosa, and Justin Herbert, the Chargers were unable to find much success during his tenure. LA made the playoffs just 3 times under Telesco, 2013, 2018, and 2022, and posted losing records in 5 seasons, including obviously this season. Between the high-profile losses and falling short of overall expectations, the Chargers decided to make some major changes, and rightfully so. With less than 3 seasons as head coach, Staley's run becomes the organization's shortest since Kevin Gilbride lasted only 22 games from 1997 to 98. The Chargers will now look to replace the 41-year-old, although the opening should draw interest from every top candidate available. Few vacancies have a proven franchise quarterback like Justin Herbert on a playoff-ready team in a city like Los Angeles. So I'm sure they'll be seeking a new GM as well. So ladies and gentlemen, this is all we have for this episode of the Sean Sports Talk Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. I love you guys. And Glasnow's a Dodger. Otani's a Dodger. You got to love it. And I'll see you guys in the next one. Peace.